New York. This is Democracy Now!
She told me they stuck her hand, that the doctor stuck his hand on her private parts, Mr. Speaker. I am told one woman has been bleeding for more than 2 weeks. Let's shut down this center. Let's arrest the doctors and anybody that was involved in perpetrating this crime.
At least 19 immigrant women have now come forward to allege they were pressured into unnecessary gynecological treatment and surgeries while they were jailed by ICE at the Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia. Some of the procedures left the women sterile. We'll look at a shocking new report on the mistreatment of the women, speak to a survivor of medical abuse at Irwin, and Congressmember Adriano Espaillat, the first formerly undocumented immigrant to be elected to Congress. He visited the women in Irwin. Then we share the story of a Palestinian-American family living in Trump country, the highly conservative town of Appomattox, Virginia, where Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant in 1865.
We know everybody in town.
Yes.
I mean, we don't have any grudges against any of them, and none of them have grudges against us. They like us.
Politics, especially when we came, like, really long time ago, it wasn't that big of a deal. It's different now, maybe.
We'll speak to filmmaker Nadine Natour, who tells the story of her own parents in the short documentary Natour's Grocery. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Confirmed cases of COVID-19 are continuing to surge in the United States, as more than 83,000 new infections were recorded on both Friday and Saturday, the highest daily total since the pandemic began. Hospitalizations rose in 38 states over the past week. Total confirmed cases in the U.S. have now topped 8.6 million, with a death toll over 225,000, both numbers the highest in the world. A new outbreak in the White House has infected at least five of Vice President Mike Pence's aides. In spite of the news, Pence, who the White House says has tested negative, has continued campaigning and is refusing to quarantine in defiance of guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows was questioned by CNN's Jake Tapper Sunday.
We're not going to control the pandemic. We are going to control the fact that we get vaccines, therapeutics, and other mitigation.
Why aren't we going to get control of the pandemic?
Because it is a contagious virus, just like the flu.
Yeah, but why not make efforts to contain it?
Well, we are making efforts to contain it.
By running all over the country and not wearing a mask?
Pence's Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Trump's Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, also confirmed in his interview reports the White House attempted to keep news of the outbreak from the public. Democratic vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris spoke out Sunday about her rival Mike Pence.
Listen, he should be following the guidelines. We're doing it. I think we have modeled the right and good behavior, and they should take our lead.
Pence is the head of the coronavirus task force. Meanwhile, President Trump and Joe Biden continued campaigning over the weekend. On Friday, Trump told voters in Florida he would, quote, quickly end this pandemic, despite the surging cases across the country. Meanwhile, Biden told supporters in his home city of Wilmington, Delaware, Trump has, quote, quit on America and assured voters he would listen to scientists and push to mandate mask wearing across the country.
Wearing a mask is not a political statement. It's a scientific imperative.
In immigration news, federal health officials say the Trump administration has been pressuring the CDC to endorse locking up migrant children at border hotels before deporting them as a way to help protect them from the pandemic. The Trump administration was forced to halt the practice last month under court order and following public outrage. On Friday, Illinois Department of Public Health Director Dr. Ngozi Ezike broke down at a news conference in Chicago when she talked about the pandemic death toll and called for widespread use of face coverings.
Today, we are reporting 3,874 new cases for a total of 364,33 confirmed cases since the start of this pandemic. Excuse me, please.
Dr. Ezike then turned away from the podium to collect herself. The World Health Organization warns countries are on a dangerous track as coronavirus cases are surging across many regions, including in Europe, where governments are introducing sweeping new measures in an effort to contain infections. Spain has declared a state of emergency and ordered a nationwide curfew. Italy imposed an early curfew for restaurants and has closed gyms, pools and movie theaters. France reported over 52,000 new cases Sunday, a new record. It now has the fifth highest caseload in the world. Meanwhile, in Poland, President Duda has tested positive for COVID-19. He said he had no symptoms so far and apologized to those who must quarantine after coming into contact with him. In Latin America, Colombia became the third country in the region to top 1 million cases, joining Brazil and Argentina. A final vote to confirm Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, is expected today, just over a week ahead of Election Day. Senate Republicans voted Sunday to move forward with the confirmation, ending a Democratic filibuster that sought to delay proceedings. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski said Saturday she would join her Republican colleagues and vote to confirm Barrett, despite voting against moving forward her confirmation on Sunday. Vice President Pence is expected to preside over the confirmation in the Senate, as many senators question his attendance there in light of his likely exposure to COVID-19, and despite the fact that Republicans have enough votes to confirm without him breaking a tie. Judge Amy Coney Barrett would be Trump's third appointee to the Supreme Court and the sixth conservative justice on the bench. During her Senate hearing, she refused to state her position on abortion rights, gay marriage, the Affordable Care Act, voting rights, climate change, family separation at the U.S.-Mexico border, and presidential powers in relation to the elections. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is deflecting questions about his own health after he was photographed on Capitol Hill with black and blue bruises above his upper lip and black and blue on one of his hands. Last Thursday, McConnell replied, "Of course not," when asked by reporters if he has any medical issues. According to the group U.S. Elections Project, over 59 million votes have already been cast in the election as early voting records have been shattered across many states. Here in New York City, where lines wrapped around blocks as early voting kicked off on Saturday, a Brooklyn police officer has been suspended without pay after social media videos circulated showing him repeatedly saying Trump 2020 through his patrol car speaker. Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez cast her ballot in the Bronx Sunday morning, where she addressed the hours-long lines.
There is no place in the United States of America where 2-, 3-, 4-hour waits to vote is acceptable. And just because it's happening in a blue state doesn't mean that it's not voter suppression.
In other election news, the Texas Supreme Court temporarily reinstated Governor Greg Abbott's order limiting ballot drop box sites to just one per county while the court reviews the case. Voters' rights groups say the governor's order will not only lower turnout, but also put people at increased risk during the pandemic. Meanwhile, in a victory for voting rights and Democrats, Pennsylvania's Supreme Court ruled Friday mail-in ballots that have mismatched signatures cannot be rejected. In more voting news from Pennsylvania, state Republicans are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to take up their case attempting to block the counting of mailed-in ballots received up to 3 days after next Tuesday, Election Day. A 4-4 deadlock last week left in place a ruling from a lower court permitting the extensions for counting ballots, but Pennsylvania Republicans hope the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett will see the court rule in their favor. Sudan and Israel have agreed to normalize diplomatic relations and open up trade and economic ties following a deal that was brokered by the United States. Sudanese political parties have rejected the agreement, warning it could trigger a new war in the country as the unelected transitional government does not have the authority to sign off on the agreement. Critics also say the deal interferes with peace talks in the Middle East. Nigeria's police chief has ordered the immediate deployment of all law enforcement resources to quell the ongoing protests against government corruption and police brutality. Demonstrations began over 3 weeks ago with calls to abolish the now-dismantled Special Anti-Robbery Squad police unit known as SARS. Dozens of protesters have been killed by security forces. At the Vatican, Pope Francis called for an end to the violence in Nigeria during his Sunday prayer. In the West African nation of Guinea, Amnesty International reports security forces have killed at least 10 protesters during demonstrations that broke out after the re-election of President Alpha Conde to a third term last week. Opposition leaders say the death toll is closer to 30 people. Opponents and critics of Conde are challenging the results of the election and say there is evidence of fraud. Armenia and Azerbaijan have resumed fighting in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh just minutes after a humanitarian ceasefire was supposed to go into effect early today. It was the third truce to fail since the conflict erupted on September 27th. Last week, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the fighting has left almost 5,000 dead on both sides, far more than the official death toll of less than 1,000 cited by governing authorities. Tens of thousands have fled their homes, with many left sheltering underground for weeks. To see our discussion about Nagorno-Karabakh, go to democracynow.org. In Belarus, over 100,000 people marched through the streets of Minsk Sunday, braving police violence as they called on President Alexander Lukashenko to resign. It was the 11th successive Sunday of protests since Lukashenko claimed victory in an election that opponents say was rigged. Protesters have launched a nationwide general strike today, backed by opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who went into exile in neighboring Lithuania in August. In Afghanistan, a suicide bombing in Kabul killed at least 24 people Saturday at an education center, many of the victims teenage students. Scores were also injured in the attack, which was claimed by the Islamic State but has not been verified. Earlier in the day, a separate attack, 9 civilians were killed after a roadside bomb tore through a passenger bus near the Afghan capital. Local police blamed the Taliban for the attack. Escalating violence in Afghanistan has come amidst ongoing peace talks between the government and Taliban officials in Qatar. Amnesty International said at least 50 people had been killed in attacks over the past week. The world must sit up and take notice. Afghan civilians are being shattered on a daily basis, said Amnesty International. In other news from Afghanistan, security officials say they have killed al-Qaeda's second-in-command, Abu Musa al-Masri, who was on the FBI's most wanted terrorist list. In Iraq, thousands of protesters took to the streets of Baghdad Sunday to mark 1 year since a new wave of anti-government demonstrations began in Iraq. Iraqi security forces fired water cannons and tear gas at protesters who continue to demand an end to government corruption and more economic opportunities. This is one of the protesters.
We are asking for our rights, rights that have been taken from us for the past 17 years. All the governments have been weak. They all have failed. The government works for foreign agendas more than they do for the citizens of the country. We, the citizens, we have nothing.
Libya's UN-backed government has signed a permanent ceasefire agreement with a rebel movement led by renegade former Libyan general Khalifa Haftar. If the truce holds, it'll pave the way for ending a civil war that split Libya between East and West since 2014. In the Israeli-occupied West Bank, the family of an 18-year-old Palestinian teen who died after being beaten by Israeli forces is demanding answers. Amar Abdurrahman Snobar died of his wounds in the hospital, which health officials say were consistent with trauma inflicted by bludgeoning with rifles. In Chile, tens of thousands of people poured into the streets of Santiago and around the country Sunday evening as results came in showing an overwhelming majority voted to rewrite Chile's Pinochet dictatorship-era constitution. 1 year after mass protests rocked Chile, many hope the historic referendum will lead to changes in social and economic inequalities, address police brutality, expand access to education and indigenous sovereignty. Pope Francis named Washington, D.C. Archbishop Wilton Gregory as one of 13 new Roman Catholic cardinals. He'll become the first African-American to hold the rank. Gregory spoke out against police brutality and racism following the police killing of George Floyd in May. In June, the archbishop blasted Trump after police used tear gas and other violent tactics against protesters to clear a path to St. John's Church so Trump could have a photo op while holding up a Bible. Federal prosecutors have arrested a self-described leader of the far-right Boogaloo movement in connection with the burning of a Minneapolis police precinct in May. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota says 26-year-old Ivan Harrison Hunter fired 13 rounds from a semi-automatic assault rifle into the third precinct during protests against the police killing of George Floyd. The Boogaloo boys promote violent acts aimed at sparking civil war in the United States. They've been linked to more than 24 arrests and 5 deaths this year. Meanwhile, Alicia Garza, the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter Global Network, said she was recently approached by the FBI after agents found her name on a list in the home of a white supremacist in Idaho who was recently arrested on weapons charges. Garza tweeted, quote, "This is why this president is so dangerous. He's stoking fires he has no intention of controlling." Alicia Garza will join us on Tuesday on Democracy Now! In Colorado, the state's two largest fires on record, the Cameron Peak and the East Troublesome fires, continue to rage as scientists warn such events will become more common due to climate change-induced heat waves and droughts. Together, the two fires have turned over 400,000 acres so far, but authorities say weekend snowfall has helped slow the fire's progression. An elderly couple was killed by the East Troublesome blazes last week after refusing evacuation orders. Meanwhile, in California, authorities warn intense winds could exacerbate what's already the worst fire season on record. Pacific Gas and Electric said they're cutting power to over 360,000 customers in Northern California Sunday, and over 30 million people in the region are under a red flag wildfire warning through Tuesday. And a United Nations treaty banning nuclear weapons is set to go into effect in 90 days. On Saturday, Honduras became the 50th nation to ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which bans the development, testing and possession of nuclear warheads, as well as any threat to use such weapons. The treaty has not been signed by any of the world's 9 nuclear powers: Britain, China, France, India, Israel, North Korea, Pakistan, Russia and the United States. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. When we come back, at least 19 immigrant women have now come forward to allege they were pressured into unnecessary gynecological treatment and surgeries at an ICE jail in Georgia, the procedures leaving some of them sterile. We'll speak to a survivor and a doctor who reviewed her records for a shocking new report that will be presented today to the Senate Democratic Caucus. Stay with us. By Pafchins here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 19 women have now come forward to allege they were pressured into unnecessary gynecological treatment and surgeries, including procedures that left them sterile, while they were imprisoned by Immigration and Customs Enforcement at the Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia. The women are mostly Black and Latina. They were all patients of Dr. Mahendra Amin, the primary gynecologist linked to the jail. In a shocking new report submitted to Congress Thursday, an independent medical review team of 9 board-certified OBGYNs and 2 nursing experts examined more than 3,200 pages of the women's medical records and said they found a lack of informed consent and a, quote, disturbing pattern of questionable gynecological surgical procedures. Today, they'll present their findings to the Senate Democratic Caucus. This comes after whistleblowing nurse Dawn Wooten first spoke out in September about an alarmingly high rate of hysterectomies performed on women at the ICE jail, prompting congressional and federal investigations. An ICE spokesperson said the allegations in the new report raise, quote, serious concerns that deserve to be investigated quickly and thoroughly. Meanwhile, the private prison company that operates Irwin, LaSalle Corrections, said it could not comment during the pending investigation. For more, we're joined by 3 guests. Jaramí Floriana Navarro is a survivor of medical abuse and neglect at Irwin. She was the original source of the information about a medical abuse by Dr. Mahendra Amin that was eventually included in the whistleblower report. She's in Mexico right now. Also with us from Chicago, Illinois, is Dr. Maggie Mueller. She was part of the independent medical review team that produced the new report. She's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern Medical Center. And we're joined by Democratic Congressman Adriano Espaillat of New York, who was part of a delegation from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus that visited the Irwin County Jail in September, where he met with jailed women who alleged Dr. Amin conducted unnecessary medical procedures on them without their full knowledge and consent. Congressmember Espaillat is the first Dominican-American and the first formerly undocumented immigrant to serve in Congress. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! I want to begin with the doctor. Dr. Mueller, if you can talk about what you found happened at Irwin.
Absolutely. So what we were able to identify, there was really what we think is a concerning pattern of, number one, overly aggressive management of women's complaints or lack thereof complaints, actually, as well as significant lack of informed consent for these women who underwent procedures that they then acknowledged they didn't understand they were going to undergo.
And talk about how extensive this was, what these procedures were. We're not talking about one woman or two women. We're talking about at least 19 women. What were they told? Where did this happen? And how many do you understand were actually given hysterectomies without their knowledge?
Yeah, so I think that's a very important point of clarification. So as you said, we did review 19 cases where we had medical records of women who received care with Dr. Amin. What I mentioned is a pattern, the pattern of overly aggressive procedures. This is not necessarily focusing on hysterectomy or sterilization procedures, but still important surgical procedures that can have implications later on in life. So, for example, taking a patient that really didn't have any gynecologic complaints, not working them up appropriately, and then performing additional procedures like a dilation and curettage, or a diagnostic laparoscopic procedure, and then recommending even more aggressive therapy.
What does he gain by doing this? I ask this because in 2013, Georgia and federal investigators sued Dr. Amin. This is like 7 years ago. The Hospital Authority of Irwin County and a group of other doctors over allegations they falsely billed Medicare and Medicaid. Does he make money off of these hysterectomies?
Well, honestly, I think that's outside of my my ability to make a determination. I am an expert medical witness. I'm able to review medical records and determine whether or not the standard of care was breached. I can't comment as to what the motivation behind this was, but certainly it warrants further investigation, and that's what we are asking for with this report.
Well, I want to go to Jaramí Floriana Navarro. We are speaking to you in Aguascalientes, Mexico. Can you talk about when you were held at Irwin and what happened to you?
Yes, of course. I was held in Irwin from October 18, 2019, all the way to September 15, 2020. And I met Dr. Amin March of 2020 because I told the nurse that I had heavy cramps and that all I wanted was some medication, like ibuprofen or something. But instead, she sent me to Dr. Amin for my cramps, and I also had an infection, a vaginal infection. And from day one that I met Dr. Amin, he said, okay, you need surgery. He did a vaginal ultrasound with the wand, and I didn't even know he was going to do that. To be honest with you, I didn't know that I was going to have to take my pants off or lay on that bed and let him look at me. I didn't know that. Nobody ever told me that I was going to have a vaginal ultrasound.
Was he doing this in his office or at the Irwin jail?
No, it was not at the Irwin County Jail. It was at his office.
Uh-huh. So you were brought there from the detention facility. So go on from there.
Yes, they took me there, I must say, about 40 times from March to September, to be honest with you. He told me right off the bat, he said, you have a cyst, and it's not big, but it could grow, and we need to do a surgery. That was the first time I had ever heard I had a cyst or seen him, and he told me right off the bat. I was super afraid. I didn't know what a cyst was or how it formed. He didn't explain to me none of the above. He didn't care. He just wanted to do the surgery. He gave me medication for my infection. And then he said that he was going to put a depot shot on me because that would help the cyst go away. Basically, I didn't have a choice. He said that Irwin County Detention Center is no good at keeping up with any medication and that the depot shot would be the most effective and that it would work for my favor because I didn't have to depend on Irwin County Detention Center to give me my pills, which it would be any other type of medication for hormones. So I was left with no choice. And so I had to pick the depot. After the depot, I was bleeding. I wasn't bleeding heavy, but I was spotting for an entire month. And I told the nurse that I was spotting after the depot. And I have two kids. I've had the depot before. I had never experienced those type of symptoms. They took me back to see Dr. Amin from March to July at least 25 times. They would take me out constantly to go see him. He would always check me. If it wasn't with his fingers, then it would be with the wand. And to be honest with you, it was uncomfortable each and every time. I didn't like anything he ever did. I didn't like his posture. I didn't like the way he stood in front of me or rested his hand on my knee as he did the vaginal search or whatever he was doing. And it was uncomfortable, to be honest with you. He kept telling me every single time I would see him that I was going to have a surgery. But for some reason, I never knew when the surgery was going to be. Finally, when it came time for me to have my second round or my second dose, my second round of the depot shot.
You're talking about July the drug 31st. Depot Provera.
Yes. He gave me that shot March, and he gave me that shot again in July, about the middle of July. He was supposed to give me this shot by the endings of June, but he didn't. And that was the first red flag that I realized, because I thought to myself, how is it that he doesn't even know when it's my third month mark? He's not even giving me the shot the way it's supposed to be or by the time it's supposed to be. How is it that my cyst is going to go away if he's not doing this properly? So that was my first concern. And I told the nurse, I told her, how is it that he doesn't have any medical records on his computer? Does it not tell him when it's supposed to be the third month? I don't understand why he didn't give me the shot by the end of June. when I complained, they took me back to see him around June 12th. It was around the second week of July. It was me and Juridia. We both went to see him, and he told her and me that we both need a surgery. That was also Juridia's first time seeing Dr. Amin.
She, too, an immigrant prisoner at Irwin.
Yes, she had the surgery performed. I denied it. So July 31st was 2 weeks after we went to see him, and that was the day that it was recorded for me to have my surgery. To my knowledge, as far as the information I was able to collect, I knew that I was going to have my cyst drained, and that was it. That morning when Ms. Vaughn picked me up, she asked me, as they were putting on the chains on me, she asked me, do you know where you're going, what procedure you're going to have? And I was like, no, I think I'm going to see Dr. Amin to have my cyst drained. And she smirked. She said, and that was it. I knew, I heard her, but I was just like, okay, that was odd, whatever. And so they took me to the hospital, which is about, conveniently, is about 15 to 10 minutes from Irwin County Detention top. And so we get to the hospital, and, you know, because of the pandemic, they have to do tests on us. They did the nose swab, and they checked my blood. They took me to the room to prep me. I had to sign papers saying, to my knowledge, because the nurse didn't allow me to read the paper, even though I wanted to. She didn't allow me to read the paper, the consent form, which said that if anything happens to me during the surgery, they weren't responsible. So I knew that she said that that's what it said. And I thought it was just crazy. Like, how am I signing this paper, although Dr. Amin is telling me that I need this surgery before anything happens to the cyst inside my body? I signed the paper. They took me to the room. They prepped me up. They put the IV. I had to take my clothes off, wait for the anesthesia person to come and put the anesthesia on me to go to sleep. Before the anesthesia person could come in and put me to sleep, Ms. Vaughn and I were speaking, and we were getting to know each other. She was very polite. She was showing me pictures of her kids, and we were talking there for a minute. When at the end of the conversation, she said, you know, you're having a hysterectomy. I was going to have my womb removed. And I had heard that word before a lot in Irwin County. So I knew that a hysterectomy was to remove our woman parts. And when she said that, I looked at her and I didn't say anything. I just automatically prayed. I said, Lord, did you hear what she said? That's outrageous. What is she talking about? And as soon as I finished my thoughts, the other officer who went to get food for them to eat came back and he told her, hey, they need to speak with you. So my heart just raced when he said that. My heart was already beating fast when she said I was going to have a hysterectomy. But when he said they need to speak with you, I knew something wasn't right. And she came back in the room and she told me, they can't do the surgery because you have antibodies for COVID. My whole world sinked at the moment, and I thought I was going to die because of COVID. I mean, I've been locked in there. It's dirty. They don't feed us correctly. They don't take care of us. They don't care how many medical requests we put for COVID. They didn't care. So I just was like lost, you know, being in place locked up all day, every day with no sunlight, under constant LSD lights. It's just constant illumination. It's like a low grade of torture. So I just, all of that just ran through my mind as they were telling me I had COVID, antibody COVID. And luckily they couldn't do the surgery on me. They couldn't perform the surgery on me because of the antibodies. And the nurse came in the room and said that Dr. Amin was going to be pissed because he wasn't going to be able to perform the surgery on me. And she took the IVs out, and they just told me they'll reschedule it. And Ms. Vaughn took me back to Irwin County Detention Center. They had to isolate me for a minute. And when they took me back to Irwin County Detention Center, they wouldn't tell the other ladies that I had COVID. They told the ladies that I was going home. And that's why they were taking out my stuff from the pod. But I was able to kind of tell them before I left through the window that I had COVID. And that the reason why I wasn't going back in there and they were taking my things out of there was because I had COVID. And they rescheduled this surgery for August the 14th. They were in a rush to do this to me. I was supposed to be gone by the endings of July, by the endings of, excuse me, after July, August. I was supposed to be gone by August, but they held me there just trying to do the surgery on me for an entire a month and a half. That's not normal. My appeal was over July 31st. I should have been gone 2 weeks after that, to be honest with you. That is how the process goes. My appeal lasted 6 months. I was already there for a long time. After that month of July, I was supposed to be gone at least a week or 2 weeks later. But no, they held me there. They were really trying to do the surgery on me for whatever reason. They wanted to take my womb out. I refused it, though. August the 14th, I refused that surgery. Before August the 14th, I was speaking with Ms. Hughes, and I was telling her, hey, there's something not right, because the officer said I was going to have my womb removed, and I don't appreciate that at all, because that's not what I signed for. You guys never told me that's what you guys were going to do. Dr. Amin said he was going to do a DNC. He said he was going to drain my cyst. He never said anything about going into my vagina, doing anything through my vagina. He said he was going to drain a cyst, that it was a 20-minute process, 3 holes on my stomach, one by my belly, by my womb, and down one a little under my womb, by my vagina. That's all he said. He never said anything about going into my vaginal area. But when I told Ms. Hughes this, she changed her story about 4 times. She said that Dr. Amin had to request a heavy bleeding procedure, a heavy bleeding surgery on me, because if not, then ICE would have not approved this process.
Hanami, when did you get deported in this process?
In this process, I got deported September 16, which is the day after the whistleblower report came out. And I was in shock when I found out that the day after this came out, I got deported, to be honest with you.
Do you feel like they were deporting you so that you would not speak out?
Of course. Of course, that's why they were deporting me. I knew it. I came back from signing my deportation September 15th, which was the same day that I went back to see Dr. Amin. And he was pissed. He was like, why didn't you get the surgery? Who told you to say no? And I was like, excuse me? It was a misunderstanding. Stories were being changed. How was I supposed to say yes? I'm not going to undergo a surgery that I have no knowledge of. He was angry and deported me the next day. And that's the day I found out, September 15th, I found out that there was a report that went viral. And everybody in Irwin County Detention Center, the officers, were all asking if it was me who had spoken up. And I was like, yes, it was me. I told the lawyer that you guys were doing illegal surgeries here, because that's how I felt.
Let me bring in Congressmember Adriano Espaillat. You went down to Irwin. You spoke with women there. You are Dominican American. You're the first undocumented immigrant to be elected to Congress, formerly undocumented. Can you talk about what you found? How typical is Jaramie's experience and what the hearing today is all about in Congress?
Well, Amy, just first let me congratulate this young lady for her courage, as well as the whistleblower who we met with the day before we visited Irwin Correctional Detention Center. As I heard her tell her story, the one thing that stood out is that she is very fluent in English. And most of the ladies there are not. And so imagine being subjected to this kind of treatment and not really understanding what's being said to you. So this is this was a critical piece, because to have informed consent, as you said, Amy, you must understand what they're telling you. You must understand what your options are and what your condition is. And so when we met with the ladies there, let me just say that I was really taken aback by the level of fear that they expressed. And that was one thing that they consistently asked for, was for us to protect them. They felt that if they spoke out, they would wind up in solitary confinement. And so as the young lady just said, this was sort of like a low grade of torture. And they expressed how aggressively they were being treated by this doctor. In fact, there was 8 women that we spoke to, and 2 of them were Asian women from China, and they didn't have a translator there, so we couldn't really speak to them. But out of the other 6, 4 of them had been treated by Dr. Ramin, and they all expressed concern as to the aggressiveness of the test, the lack of information, and as such, the lack of an informed consent. And so this is the critical piece right here. Were they consenting to these very aggressive treatments or procedures? And if so, and if not, then, you know, they're in clear violation. And I'm calling for the shutdown of the center and the arrest. Any doctor that would subject his patients to this type of treatment anywhere in America could be subject to be arrested.
So you're calling for a means arrest. Also, clearly the detention center was working with him.
Well, that should be part of the investigation. The detention center, as you know, is run by a privately owned corporation, LaSalle. We got to follow the money and see whether there was any profit incentive to aggressively submit these women to these very aggressive procedures that I suspect are also more expensive. And so they cost more money. So we want to see whether there was also a profit incentive to subject the women to this kind of what the young lady calls low grade of torture. And so, yes, there should be a very deep and extensive investigation on this. We want to know if this is just isolated or is it a common practice in detention centers across America as well.
How do you know the women who are being held there right now are not being subjected to the same thing?
That's correct. They could continue to be. This doctor has a problem history with Medicaid fraud, and as well, the women have expressed to us, the ones that we spoke to, their fear that they will be subjected to solitary confinement. We don't know if they're still being subjected to the same kind of treatment that they have been subjected to for many, many years. So we are concerned. The whistleblower was very specific as to her denunciations, and we're proud of her courage as well. But this must be investigated. This is horrendous. One of the women that I spoke to, a Dominican woman, told me that she was treated like an animal. And we were able to contact the Dominican consulate in Georgia and Florida, in Miami, Florida, and 5 of the Dominican women who wanted to either be released or deported back home were sent back home. ICE alleged that the Dominican government never gave them the documents that they needed. When we called the Dominican government, the consulate, they told us that they were never contacted. So this hurry to extend the stay there for as long as possible to get in these procedures is highly questionable, if not criminal.
Harami, 2 quick questions before we go. Did you say you were chained to the bed?
No, I was not chained to the bed.
Uh-huh. And are you asking to be let back into the United States?
Of course I am. I deserve to be let back in the United States.
And so let me ask Congressmember Adriano Espaillat, Ken Jaramillo Floriano Navarro, how could this deportation be reversed, given what she has identified here? Cameroonian, one of the Cameroonian women, two were deported, but one whose sterilization became very well known was actually taken off the flight in Chicago to be deported. So she has remained now in the United States. Can Jaramillo Floriano Navarro, can you facilitate her return?
We will fight to bring her back. She is a victim. And she was subject to what she called a low grade of torture, what I think is also a low grade of torture. She should be allowed back in and treated. Certainly, my office will be willing to work with the lawyers and with her to see if there's a way that we can bring her back to the United States. I am also concerned that these women were readily and speedily ushered out of the United States to prevent them, to silence them, to keep them from saying their stories, as the story was well and eloquently said today. It's horrendous. This is the same kind of stories that we heard from the women that we interview at the detention center, and this must be fully investigated. Irwin must be shut down. Dr. Amin must be arrested.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Congressmember Adriano Espaillat is speaking to us, Congressmember from New York, again, the first formerly undocumented immigrant to become a member of Congress. Jaramillo Floriano Navarro speaking to us from Mexico, where the U.S. deported her to. She is demanding to be let back into the United States, a survivor of Dr. Amin. And Dr. Maggie Mueller of the Northwestern Medical Center in Chicago, who's done the big report that we will link to, talking about the number of women, almost 20, that they know of who experienced these kinds of threats or actual sterilizations or surgeries without proper informed consent. When we come back, we share the story of a Palestinian-American family living in Trump country in the very conservative town of Appomattox, Virginia. We'll speak to filmmaker Nadine Nator about her family. Stay with us.
Child will know what you haven't told. His present will be past. He'll ride the time to another state of mind that won't last. 'Cause he'll grow and die, and they would set him free. At I shouted, these children are I. The child will grow and fall and crawl and till he would not feel upon them purple gods and these 10 almost tears. I set the fire on those kitchen's walls, yet I shouted, these children are my fault. Yet I whispered, these children aren't my.
Children Are I by Rasha Nahas. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As the presidential race enters its final full week, President Trump's continuing to run a campaign filled with attacks on immigrants and even immigrant members of Congress. During one recent rally in Michigan, Trump claimed Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, quote, truly hates our country, he said. Omar is the first Somali-American elected to Congress, and along with Rashida Tlaib, a Palestinian-American congressmember, one of just two Muslim women ever elected to Congress. Well, today we take a look at what it's like for one Palestinian-American family living in Trump's America. In a short documentary titled Nator's Grocery, the filmmaker Nadine Nator shares the story of her immigrant parents who own a store in the highly conservative town of Appomattox, Virginia, which voted for President Trump in 2016.
We know everybody in town.
Yes.
I mean, we don't have any grudges against any of them. None of them have grudges against us. They like us.
Politics, especially when we came, like, really long time ago, it wasn't that big of a deal. It's different now, maybe.
I think Islam hates us.
There's a level of hatred with
certain community, in this case, the Muslim community.
We have to look at the Muslims and we have to do something. We cannot stand by and be the stupid people while our country is destroyed.
Motto that do not talk about politics or religion with your customer. If you do, you lose them.
The Nature Store is in the small Virginia town of Appomattox, best known as where Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant, effectively ending the Civil War in 1865.
Appomattox is beautiful.
Everybody knows everybody.
In between Lynchburg and Richmond.
There ain't much to do around here.
A little redneck, a whole lot of redneck.
Appomattox is mainly known for the end of the Civil War, where Robert E. Lee surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant. The War of Northern Aggression. I won't say that.
No, I just said,
you got me.
For the Nators, their roots are thousands of miles away in Palestine.
I was born and raised in Colenso in Palestine. In 1948, Palestine was occupied by Israel. The only jobs for us was laborers at Jewish settlements, and I couldn't do that. So I decided to become a farmer. I got enough money to buy a ticket to the United States.
While the Nators say they don't talk about politics or religion with their customers, Saba Nator does share some of her cultural heritage.
Hey, would you like to try my dessert? I made it's like a Mediterranean dessert.
This is baklava. It's made with layer pastries and nuts and spices. Okay. And this is made out of cream wheat.
Oh.
So I started to bring in desserts.
That's good right there. Okay.
It was kind of like building bridges between us and the customers.
While the Nators build bridges with their neighbors, President Trump's anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim rhetoric has inspired a backlash in Appomattox.
If you're not happy in the U.S., if you're complaining all the time, very simply, you can leave. You can leave right now.
A Virginia church is echoing that sentiment with this billboard that says, America, love it or leave it. Pastor E.W. Lucas put up the sign at Friendship Baptist Church in Appomattox. Some members of his church led the congregation out of the service in a stance against him.
Yeah, when I saw him on the news last week, I told my wife to go to church Sunday.
You're going to church Sunday?
Going
to do what?
Just to support that preacher.
To support the preacher?
Right.
Why? Why is it that the church is supposed to love everybody?
His congregation abandoned him and walked out.
The Bible inspired the Declaration of Independence. We got our system of government from the Bible. Don't talk to me about that flag out yonder or that sign out yonder. This is our country. And it was our country long before they ever came across the waters and got over here. My country is...
Excerpts from the short documentary Nator's Grocery. It premieres tonight as part of the POV Shorts on PBS. We're joined by the film's director, Nadine Nator. She is an associate producer on the Oscar-nominated film RBG. Nadine here is telling her own family story. Those are her parents who run the grocery store. She's the oldest of four daughters. Nadine, thanks so much for joining us on Democracy Now! We don't have much time, and I want you to get to the heart of this story. You're growing up in one of the most conservative areas of the United States, and how, from you to your youngest sister, you feel the area has changed.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy. Yes, so while I was growing up, I really didn't pay that much attention to being Muslim, to being Arab. My parents came from Palestine, and it was just sort of part of growing up. We're a secular family, didn't pay too much attention to that. But as the years progressed and we saw different administrations come and go, and the climate for American Muslims became a bit more worrisome. So in the election of Donald Trump, we saw a lot of that bubbling racist sentiment towards immigrants, towards Muslim, become part of the mainstream discourse. And whereas I really never thought about it, when it comes to my youngest sister, who you see in the film, she fended off ignorant comments or attacks on her heritage as she was going through school. So you really could see a shift in the attitude towards Muslims, towards immigrants, and especially with the election of Donald Trump, the underlying discourse sort of was brought out into the open.
Your father is known as G by the community as he runs Nature's Grocery. His name actually is Jihad, is that right?
Yes, that's
Did
correct.
Did he shorten it because he felt it might not go over well in this part of the country?
You know, at the time, I don't think that association was being made yet. And he probably just wanted people to have the ease of saying a name quickly, just as many immigrants are looking for ways to sort of adapt and blend in with the community that becomes their new home. But yes, his name is Jihad.
And after 9/11, how you felt?
You know, after 9/11, there wasn't necessarily a huge shift in my experience. But for someone, my sister was born the day after. So for someone like her, it really made a difference in the way that she experienced, you know, feeling like a part of the town. But this was what I really wanted to explore in the film, was that we really felt a tremendous amount of love from the people in our town. And it was interesting to me to talk to our customers and people in Appomattox about why they voted for someone who was saying anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim sentiments as part of their campaign and as part of their platform. And I think it's important that no matter, you know, who gets into office in the next election, that we sort of make sure we can protect the Muslim America as part of the country.
And I wanted to bring in Julie Cohen, finally, the producer of this film, who also produced and directed the Oscar-nominated film RBG. Julie, why you got involved with Nadine's film?
First of all, because my belief in Nadine as a filmmaker, but also just the story of her family is so incredible. I mean, you hear those sound bites at the beginning and that you were mentioning of Donald Trump saying, Muslims hate this country. I mean, when you see this film, the Nadine's family represents in every way so beautifully the American dream. And to think that there's this huge misunderstanding at best and, you know, just really, really ugly hatred at worst, is just feels like it's a misunderstanding that really needs some clearing up. And Nadine has done a gorgeous job of doing that.
And Julie, as you did RBG, your thoughts today on what is the probable confirmation vote for Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett? We have 15 seconds.
Well, you know, it looks like it's happening. If there were ever a time that we needed a voice of dissent, what Justice Ginsburg so beautifully provided, it's now. I think, you know, with the threat of rights being peeled back, I think many of us are concerned.
We have to leave it there. Yeah. Thank you so much, Julie Cohen and 18 Netto.